So today we move into the second section. It is Tinghanta Padam. Padam means word. Tinghanta means ending in ting. It's a technical term which Panini is using for the verb. And it's quite interesting that he does not make any distinction, as we know. Sup Tinghantam Padam. Padam is of two kinds, sup and ting. So there are two types of words, verbs and nouns. Even not verbs and nouns, but those which are falling into the category more of noun and those who are falling into the category of those of the verb. And there is no other distinction. And there was a debate why he really does not go deeper into this subject, what is the difference between the two. And we saw last time that it is not very easy to make this distinction, because both share features of each other. So we have such a phenomenon as a participle. Participle is a noun made from the verb. So it is adjectives. Yes, it's in itself is an adjective which carries the quality of the verb, but it is used as a noun. And also opposite, there are denominatives. From any name or noun, you can produce a verb. As in English, we have to mother. To mother is a very interesting verb. Or to sister. Or to brother. I do not know what else you can do there. Most probably everything. You can take any noun and make it a verb. That means there is a shift somewhere in perception what it is. And what is that shift?
We do that in German also, for teacher to teach. You know, we use the word as a literary to teach us something, so to say. Mm-hmm. We're using the noun without changing meaning.
Yes. In Sanskrit it is the same, putrayate. Yes, you can take putra and make, behave like putra, behave like the son. And so on. So then we moved into this very beautiful vision. We saw that Karakas and Vibhaktis are not matching, but they are following the same order or the same logic, starting from the doer and ending with starting with Karta and ending with Adhikarana, location of this action of the actor. So all the possible movements of consciousness are expressed here in the system of Karakas. And they are numbered by Vibhaktis, first, second, third, up to seventh. There is one more Vibhakti I didn't mention. It is Ashtami Vibhakti, eighth Vibhakti, which is not considered to be in the system of these Karakas, neither no Vibhaktis. It is Sambodhanam. And you can clearly understand why vocative case cannot be introduced into these cases. Do you have an idea why vocative is not part of the system of this? Of the nominative, accusative, instrumental, dative, ablative, genitive and locative? Vocative is not a part of this system.
It's an expression, it's not separate from an already existing name. It's merely an emphasis on the name.
It's an intuitive kind of approach, but there is a more definite answer, very simply answer.
So
it stays
alone.
Huh? Say it.
Stays alone.
Stays alone, okay, this is also close to it, but this the answer is simply, it is a second person. So all these Karakas belong to the third person. They are describing something of the name, what is happening. Sambodhanam, saying Nishtha, is not the third person. It's an address. So this address is not of the same kind as these Karakas. So it's an immediate action by the name. Yeah? It's the same as we have in the system of the verbs. We have an imperative. Sit, come, look, Nishtha, Kirti, and so on. So this kind of address, immediate address, cannot be used out of context. It is only in the context when it is used. So it is not a part of the system of the third person treatment. And these are all third person treatment. Yes, now there is this whole soup paradigm for those who want to study Sanskrit. Soup is very important, and better you learn it by heart, because it will give you then an access to half of the verbs. Oh, sorry, nouns. Yes, you can easily manage then with Sanskrit grammar. Now we are moving into another dimension, tingānta padam. Ending on ting, it's a definition of the verb by Panini. And here we have a very interesting division on two types, parasmaipadam and atmanepadam. There is one more type, which is bhave prayogaha, or we call it passive voice. So there was no yet passive voice in the Veda. It's also interesting. There was only atmanepadam. Atmanepadam was used for the passive voice. Parasmaipadam is indicative, or we call it active voice. Yes? This active voice means parasmai, to the other, padam, word. Word for the other. Also we have another term for it, transitive verbs. Yes, I speak something to somebody. I don't speak to myself. When I speak to myself, it is atmanepadam. So atmanepadam is word for oneself. Parasmaipadam, word for the other. This shift is very subtle, and we always use it. In English language it will be that self, what we are using all the time, putting self. I understand myself is atmanepadam. I understand the subject is parasmaipadam. I understand something and I understand myself. To understand oneself is atmanepadam. There can be better examples used with yajati yajate. Usually it is used this in the literature. When he sacrifices to Vishnu for the sake of the king. Yes, Vishnu yajati nripaya. And then if it is used yajate, atmanepadam, then it will be never for anybody's sake. It won't be mentioned, because it's clear that he sacrifices for himself, for his own sake, to Vishnu. He sacrifices Vishnu for himself. Vishnum yajate. Vishnum yajati nripaya. He sacrifices Vishnu for the king. For the king's prosperity. He ordered the sacrifice, as priests are doing usually. They perform certain ritual for the order they got. Now, what is interesting here, that these two have a particular arrangement, and you can see how it is arranged. Pratthama Purusha is the third person, though Pratthama Purusha is the first person. In Sanskrit grammar, the third person is the first person, not the third. The counting is not starting from I as the first. Yeah? It's quite interesting. The first is he, she, it, they. Madhyama Purusha is the middle man, middle persona. So this middle persona is the second person in English. Yeah? But here it is middle. It's not second. It's that with whom you have immediate relations. In the verb or noun. That will be sambodhana in the noun. Vocative case, and here there will be madhyama purusha. And uttama purusha, the highest purusha, the supreme purusha, is I. So it's very strange that first Purusha is the third Purusha. Why to say first, if there is no second and there is no third? There is no answer to it. You can think why it is the first Purusha. First means most probably objectively existing. Whereas first and second Purusha, these are not objectively existing entities. They are very subjectively related to the context and an immediate relation. They cannot be objectivized. Once they are objectivized, they are becoming Pratthama Purusha, first Purusha. Does it make sense? Not much, no? A little bit. For me also, it's a puzzle. Huh?
It's as if only then you give it the body and you make it into that self. I don't know. I mean, there's a difference between the one that you communicate. If you speak about that with which you communicate, you make it into something else and we do that sometimes.
Yes.
Maybe in, like in Tamil, for example, also there's that way, if you speak about the third person, in his presence, you have to use the total polite word. In his absence, there's still a good polite word and there's a group word also. As if this relates something to this. What is that if somebody in the third person who is not present? What importance is it?
Actually, the first Purusha here, the third person, is the way to speak politely also. Politely means have a distance from it. So there is Supreme Purusha and immediate Purusha. These are kind of not polite relations, very intimate relations. But when you speak about Bhavan Icchati or Bhavan Gacchati, that is the third Purusha. Sir is going and he is, and they are coming, and you speak in those terms. Yeah? Not only in Bahuvachanam, but also in Purusha, the shift of Purusha. You have this in Hindi also, no? In German. Everywhere, in Russian.
Oh,
yes, English. You don't have? Sir?
Sir, yes.
But sir in second person, not in the third. You have sir in this first person, in this third person in India. Sir has said, sir asked, sir left, which is very difficult to understand because it's not proper English, most probably. Sir can be only an address of the second person, no? Or can be used in the third also.
It's a very formal way of
speaking. It's a special manner.
But can you use it in the third person? So sir is coming.
You would have to say, if it was lowercase, as the sir.
It's a translation. When it's used in English, it's just a translation from Hindi.
Yes, that's what I thought.
It's not used in English.
Yes. No, you can use sir, please come, and sir, please, second person, but you cannot, third person. Yes, that's what I thought. Sir is coming is not.
But it's being done all the time.
Yes. Yeah. I heard this also in. I went to Chennai and I saw these kids from the school. Sir is coming, sir is coming.
So, and they wouldn't even ask, they would he like some sugar in the tea, even if you trust him?
Same. Yes?
But we had to do the same as our grandparents.
Oh, right, right. I don't know.
This reminds me of some trouble.
Germany.
But the polite form, really, genuine politeness, use the third plural. And to your subject, you use the singular third person. Then you put in actually lower than yourself, you know, which is very strange. Then you put a distance which makes him low. But if you speak in general, the polite thing is the plural of the third person. To the singular person.
I know in the Polish also.
Plural.
And pan and pani and all this.
That form is obsolete now in German, I think. They used to say,
yes. Is that what you meant? Yes, I meant with such people, some people who thought themselves, you know, from the novelty, or also who tell us, this is my grandmother and my father. You know, that's their son in law, that you address them.
But
you
think it's slow,
I think there is something psychological here. Though it is culture, of course, but it is common to many cultures. So,
for example, in English, monarchs will use I, because they're so special. And in Indian culture, I have heard that a wife would never address her husband directly.
Yes. She never uses name also.
Oh, that is, yes. Well, it depends on which level you are and so on. The distinction in language also.
Spoken like, always indirectly.
Yeah. Queen, king is speaking in Sanskrit in all dramas of Kalidasa or whoever, and she answers in Prakrit. So these things, even in distinction, even in language, not to say about addressing, you cannot address directly by the name saying, hey, you. No?
I think it was from the kingdom societies that was known as speaking that you address the parents, in the newer societies you don't use it at all, change the language. I think that's very much to do with this king families and other ones that you express.
I think there is something deeper psychological here. The shift from intimate, immediate context into this objective Pratthama Purusha. That's why I'm kind of hanging around it for so long, to see that that shift and objectivization of the person and dealing with them objectively has some social status. Yes,
when it's getting lost, obviously. Because my father told me that in the time before him, that even a husband would not take his wife's name. He would say, so-and-so's mother, and call.
All right.
You see, then the wife would answer.
Dhartarashtra. So not son of Dhritarashtra. So there will be never a kind of direct name used. There will be always some kind of
relation.
Yes. So there was some shift in that perception that you directly you cannot use names. Names were, in India there are several types of several names, yes? One is for social use, one is for intimate use, and that intimate name cannot be ever used, yes? And there are nicknames. What are these nicknames? It's also a social use in special milieu, among special friends, and so on and so forth. So there is a tendency to always objectivize immediate relations. Now when we come to the relations with the intimate forces like God or beloved, yes, this changes, and immediate Madhyama Purusha is mainly used. That's why we have this vow in English for the relation with the higher force or very close beloved. You will never find them used in the third person. You will never speak to the Lord in the third person. It's impolite, it seems. So it is not about that polite is only the third person. Yes, it's a social kind of treatment. Whereas intimate stays with you with a Uttama and Madhyama Purusha. Madhyama, immediate, that mediating Purusha for you, yes, for your relations. It is not turned towards the society, it is turned towards you. So they constitute that close relation. So the same for Atmanepadam, and there are three vachanas, yes, three numbers. We have ekavachanam as usual, dvivachanam, and bahuvachanam. And it's interesting, the same like in the noun, in the three are there. Why dvivachanam is there? Again. Because there are many indispensable pairs in the world, yes? Heaven and earth, plus and minus, good and bad, cold and heat, and so on and so forth.
But this aspect that we spoke before, that if in the time of the new time the language is changing because of the society is changing, I think it's a very interesting aspect to look at it, because we get more subjective relation to everything.
Yeah, this dvivachanam follows the noun. Actually, all the numbers follows the noun. How many nouns are there? If name has ekavachanam, then verb follows ekavachanam. If dvivachanam, then it's not a need of the verb, it's a need of the noun.
Yeah? And for the interesting in Saviti, how you found this...
What do you mean?
Well,
In Savitri, what do you mean? Yeah. Okay. So basically, these two arrangements, Parasmaya Padam, Atmane Padam, are for the whole range of words. In the Vedic Sanskrit, though, there was not very often used passive voice. And it's also interesting, passive voice is another form altogether, but Atmanepadam was used for the passive voice, like in Slavic languages. In Slavic languages, we don't have pure medi, we have medio passive. Yes? When we use self, it is nearly passive, nearly, and can be used as a passive voice. For those who know that what is passive voice, it's usually very easy to understand. Yes, I am understood, or I understand myself, were nearly equally used in the Vedic Sanskrit. I am understood and I understand myself. Yeah? So if there is bhava prayoga, if there are no more specification that I am understood by them, but it's the full sentence, I am understood, it means that I understand myself. No? If I understand myself by them, that means it's passive. If not, then it is atmanepadam. So, there was a division of all the verbs in Sanskrit into two major categories, sarvadhatukas and ardhadhatukas. It's for those who study Sanskrit, it's very important. Sarvadhatukas, the definitions were four different categories. Present indicative, indicative you say, or indicative?
Indicative.
Indicative. Past imperfect, imperative and optative, respectively. They are called lat, lang, lot, vidhi, ling. Now, these sarvadhatuka forms are taking every verb and putting it into these forms. Four major forms, and I'm giving them here. I'm not going to ardhadhatuka today. Ardhadhatuka, all other forms which are not using all the verbs. Some of them are using those forms, some are not. Are used, yeah, by ardhadhatuka forms. But many are not there. So only sarvadhatuka are all the verbs available in Sanskrit. But look at this beauty. So we have four divisions. We have present, bhavati, we have not present, or imperfect. Imperfect, it's an interesting tense. It doesn't mean past tense. It means it is not finished. Spanini defines it, it is anadhyatana, anadhyatana, not today. So it may fall also into the future, if you like, but since there is no future to fall into, then it becomes past. But it is not necessarily past.
All this narrative, what you also say, or the narrative is just one variety of it? You see, because sometimes they term it in the Vedic grammar, I just read last night, this McDonald's, it's like imperfect as narrative, nothing else. It's only speaking about something.
Yes.
Which is
equating it with the historic past, historic.
Yeah, there is other form which is historic past for that, and historic future and so on. But this one is an, because it is imperfect, not today, but it is not clear when. How it is defined? It is defined in an interesting form. Bhavat is the form of the participle, that which is, which becomes. But then bhavati, bhavati, is present tense. E is actualizing this form. And abhavat, stress on a, is making it non-actual. So that which becomes is not actual for now or in this context. Since it is not actual, it falls into the domain of the past tense. But really there is no such thing. It's quite interesting.
How would you translate it?
Becoming. Becoming which is not actual, yes.
Like he was becoming.
No, we always translate as past tense because we cannot translate it otherwise. We have think.
You would have to translate it as the past continuous.
No. Oh, can be. There is no difference.
He was eating instead of he ate.
Yes, he was eating. Very good. Yes, I think it is close to this continuous.
I think it's really interesting to think about these time conceptions in the guest area way.
Yes.
Because here time is not particularly defined in consciousness.
Yes. It's not yet mental structure here. It's a mental structure yet to appear, and once it appears, then we have future tense, we have clear.
Saying the Rigveda and the explanation of the subjectivity of the tenses also is an aspect of that pre-objective, pre-temporal consciousness.
Though, of course, so mythical consciousness was temporal in a way, but differently temporal. It's not in that sense that we can clearly cut into the future, past and present. There was not such definition. There was a definition of this kind, not today.
Well, that's a contradiction. To say it was temporal and there was no future, past and present is a contradiction.
Clearly cut. No, there is no contradiction. There was no clearly cut those domains as spatial domains. There was some other perception, very subtle, in a way that this is an actual happening, and this is happening which is not actual. And that was enough to define. And then there were two more, and we will look. What else would you need to really define? You must have present tense, yes? Without present tense, there is no possibility to express anything in the verb, yes? So present tense is actually a name of the happening or the qualifier of the major name. That's what is present tense. He is going. Yeah? He is in this qualifier of this particular movement of going. Without it, we cannot say. Present tense is enough to express everything.
So I find this problem in the Tango all the time. And Tango is officially a classical language. And so these same structures are still present in the Tamil language.
Tamil is a bit also grammatically confusing, agglutinative type. It can confuse everything so much.
Anyway, you can clearly see that these kinds of structures are influencing the way conception takes place and the way things are communicated.
I wanted to go deeper into this very perception, why this non-actual, or so to say, not today, is enough to express everything what we can have. So we have this actual expression of now, yes, what is happening now. And this what is happening now is also immediate future. You can speak in present tense about immediate future, like in English, yes? I'm going to the cinema tomorrow. So, and it's fine, because how else you can express future tense, yes? If not by present. So present has a huge, diapason of application. You can also speak in present tense in the past, very easily, yes? I'm going, I'm seeing, he's coming, and we are talking, and then, and that is all happened yesterday, yes? So, it's...
This is more colloquial.
It doesn't matter. It matters that it is possible for us psychologically to treat this time as no time at all. It has no time, that's what I want to say. Present time is not present.
Is that always indicated by putting an A in front? An A before the word?
Not.
So I'm wondering what that means, asana.
Oh, yeah. Now we will come. Asana is from root as, to sit. So there's no. Okay. But asatyam, yes. Some satyam, which is not actual, yes. That means not true. Anritam, that which is not true. So how it is not true? It is truth which is not actual. So non-actuality by this a, which is stressed, is expressed in the same way in the verb. But what is interesting here, that bhavat is a major name, saying that it is becoming, but then it is not really actually now becoming. So the perception of it shifts, you know, into some indefinite time, or even not time, we can say even space, which is not definite. It doesn't matter, because time is not here. I can clearly see there is no time in this present and in this imperfect. Why it is called imperfect? Just think about it. It doesn't say anything about the past. Imperfect can be also present. Yeah, it's not actual now. It's only an aspect. Mm.
I don't know, in a little bit I learned Latin also, and there is a similar one that he uses, like I'm going, and that there, the teacher was very, you know it, but it's especially Latin, that was a special form that teach us in the Latin class, for this is like I'm going, eh? It has the same form expression. That was a special thing of they emphasized very much that the Latin language lives with this. Yeah.
So we clearly see that the major focus is this present indicative, which has two types, Atmanepadam, Parasmayapadam, yes, because the relations have to be defined of the actor to the environment or to himself more. This is the definition. And that non-actual present can be expressed as we know it as a past, but truly speaking it is non-actual present. And then we have two more forms which are indispensable. It is imperative, which are not tenses, and optative, potentialis. Now, imperative is an interesting form. Bhavatu. Now, there was bhavati, abhavat, and then suddenly bhavatu. And I thought about it quite a bit. Why this u is there? This bhavat u. Well, if to come to back to the deeper understanding of this of morphology and see why u was used, it is that which is, how to say, expressing the want, a need of some kind, tension towards, intention towards bhava too. It is that which is wanted, needed, rather than it is there, actualized. So who has this duality or this filling by this particular meaning of bhavat? Becoming is wanted, needed. And of potentialis I cannot understand, I cannot
explain.
Optative is a polite imperative.
Could, should.
Yeah, could, should. Should, could, would. Would you like to be? Would he like to be?
Should do this.
Yes, bhavet, syat, vadet. So, what is interesting in this optative is that it is imperative but with an option for the actor to choose. It is not a command, it's not a must from my, how to say, first Uttama Purusha to command you what to do. I am offering you for your choice an option, and you will choose it or not. It's up to
you.
That also is a part of the option. If I could, I would. Yes. Oh, sorry. Thank you. What?
It's around that.
So this potential mood. So what do we see here? These are the major four sarvadhatuka forms. All the verbs fall into this particular format. What can you see here? Can you see some wisdom? Because there is a wisdom. These four cover all our approaches to all our needs to express ourselves. We don't need more. These four are enough. So what do we have? We have present tense, we have past tense, we have imperative, and we have optative. What is this optative playing? It's a modality of some kind. Yes?
I think future would be this.
This optative is the future. It's a modality. By the way, optative and this potentialis is used in a classical Sanskrit as future tense. So we have present, past, future, and imperative. What else do you need?
Well,
not much more.
Subjective.
These are ardhadhatukas. Ardhadhatukas are following. Yes, there will be subjunctive, there will be injunctive, there will be many more. There will be aorist, perfect, conditionalis, there will be all kind of future, two future tenses. They are following the format. There will be benedictive, which is another kind of optative. There will be denominative. There will be desirative. There will be causative. And all those forms combined, if you like. They can be causative, desirative, benedictive. They can be anything you want and expanded as you like. That's the flexibility of Sanskrit language. Once I did this exercise and I took one root kri to do, and tried to create as many participles as I could, and you know how many I created? With a transparent kri meaning, 124 participles. If you combine desirative, causative, benedictive, all of these, and you will have perfect. And you have long, huge forms in one word, but they are readable and understandable what they mean. That's the ability of Sanskrit to go ahead with this transparent grammar. That's why it was used by Japanese to create a new, maybe in the future, computer language. Because Sanskrit is very easy to use, very transparent in its grammatical use. So, what I was calling is for this kind of admiration of these four, that present tense is sufficient to express every present, future, and past. Non-present tense is important to show that this is not actual now. Imperative, without imperative there is no verb, and without optative there is no future in some sense. Yes. Future as a modality. Yeah? Please take your seat. Yes, please take your seat is optative. It's not imperative because it is please and could you take your seat? Yes, something like this. Would you like to a cup of tea? No? This is the subject of today. We can go into many more things if you like, but this is the major material which I wanted to bring. These are the definitions by Panini for those who want to study. He calls them by these names. I found this system marvelously suggesting something of a deeper knowledge of our relation with the world through the verb. And I find it fascinating. I see that there is no need in future tense and there is no need as such in the past tense for the expression. Because the future tense is nothing but modality, a wish or a projection, or In the future tense, if I express myself, I can express as imperative. Notice I didn't show here one thing, that imperative of the first person, what would it be? How would you say in the first person imperative? Imperative is always used in the second person. Come, sit, see. How would I say to myself, come, sit, see? I can't. So what? It's used. What does it mean? Karavani. Yes.
I wish.
Yes, may I? I wish. So it is again a modality which is expressing future tense. Or wish to do something. So in a way it's quite interesting that even without a potentialis it would be sufficient with these three, because future tense is not needed and modality can be expressed by the imperative. An imperative is essential for the verb. That's my another discovery. Not the tense and not the description that he is going, but the imperative, the action by the word. Come, see, speak. May I speak? He must say. All these relations expressed subjectively through imperative define the usage of the verb.
Would you see then almost as if the third person only exists in the relation to the second person?
Yeah, to the first person. Second person exists only to relation to the first person. First
in relation to the second.
Right.
Because I talk about somebody else to whom? To the second person.
Yes.
And I
mean
for that.
Yes, I think it, yes, the first person defines everything. It defines second person in relation with oneself through the second person communication. An imperative is there, used all the time as a projection of one's intention, or wish, or communication. Communication happens through what? Not through description of the third person doing something. No, it happens through the expression of intention, of wish, of command, through imperative and optative. Optative is just a kind of a way to involve the second person through the third person. Let him decide, yeah? You, please, could you, would you, should you? This type of relation. So you let other person decide, but you suggest him the decision. So you don't tell him what to do, you suggest him what he may do. So it's of no use. It's a polite form of imperative. Do you see this? The present and imperative are essential. Now this imperfect is a helper on the way, not to confuse things too much. You cannot speak everything in the present tense. Once you change into the imperfect, it is clear that it is not now. And that clarity has to be there somehow. Otherwise, it would be too confusing. And that's it. And no more options needed. If you look into all other options in Artha Dhatuka, you will see that they will repeat these. And they will add nothing new to it. Notice this past tense.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very strange form. There are seven forms of aorist, very ancient, used mainly in the Veda, and later it is less and less used, and not all the roots are used. And it has different suffixes, sigmatic suffixes, which also suggest certain changes in the meaning, which nobody knows anymore. What is this a past tense? I do not know where it comes from. I have to check for this. I think it is most used in a grammatical literature, aorist. It is definite past. Yeah? That means it was in the past, and it clarifies that it's not imperfect, though it is close to it, but it has this
finality
in it, but this is not a perfect past. Yes, there is perfect tense also, separate, which is also used as past, but Perfect tense in Sanskrit also is very unusual because it is used parokshe lit. There is a sutra in Panini. It is when it is invisible, then perfect is used. In the parokshe, in the hidden sense, lit is used. You cannot say chakara, aham chakara, I did, yeah? I have done. You cannot say I have done, because you can say this only when you were not aware, when you were drunk to the state where you were not aware. It's even explained like this. Then you can say I have done in Sanskrit. So perfect has a very special connotation. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, the whole Bhagavad Gita, all Puranas are using perfect tense. That means the definition of it, that nobody was witnessing it. It was done in the time where nobody has access to. So it is not even time, yes? It's an action without time. It was done, but there is no time to it. Perfect tense is not tense, actually. It is rather mood.
It happened to me just last night. I was listening to some of this in my translation, and then my feeling was that what I saw, how they use language, when you have an experience, a real experience, you speak in the present and you have an experience, then you use things that are perfect. But when you say to the Lord, you did that in the past to someone, now do it for me now, he uses imperfect.
Right. It's very true. It's like as if you something has happened, but it doesn't have any time in proper sense. So because time as a context is relating us to certain events. So this is out of question. There is no relation to these events. It has taken place and it has to be mentioned as such. So it is done. It's a perfect. It's rather mood rather than
more
tense.
Like the absolute and the relative. Because the imperfect is relative and can be used for
right.
Relativity of time, perfect is in
yes.
Absolute scale.
And actually it's used also in English in the similar manner. It's not necessarily past. You see, I have it done. So I have it now done. I'm just stretching this I have done, putting it in between to show that it means now. But it is finished. Yeah. It's not even tense in some way. It's something else. It's a mood. In Islamic languages it will be visible because this perfect sense, you know, is used together with verbs. Yes, you can use it in the present, in the past. You can make this perfection of the action visible also in the future. The same you can do in English. Yes. You can say something like, I shall have done. And it won't be so wrong.
So, by tomorrow,
yes.
I will have done this.
Usually it is used in conditional mood. I should have done, I could have done. But you can say also in the future sense, I shall have done tomorrow. And not only in conditional sense. Though it has a weight on conditional, it will drag us down to the past. So all these kind of varieties follow after, but they are not essential for the expression. There is also one interesting conditional mood, you know what it is. It's future in the past. Yeah? When you say, that's exactly that, yes? Bhavishyati. It will be, but abhavishyat, it would be. Yeah? So it could be, would be, used as future in the past. And you will find that it is the same in every other language. And conjunctive is a very strange thing, which I cannot explain to you. It's like imperative, but it has exactly like imperative, but it was used more often in the Veda. And without augment, without this a in front, it becomes injunctive. And this injunctive form I even don't mention here, because it's not even listed by Panini. It is a very strange form. It's like bhavat. Bhavat is injunctive. It doesn't have bhavati, abhavat, bhavatu. It's only as if participle, but it is not participle. It is a verb. Yes, but it has all tenses and all modalities. It is according to the context that you can read it as you like. You can read it as a past tense, you can read it as a future, you can read it as a present, and or you can read it as a modality. And all of them are applicable. What kind of tense it is? It's clearly not present, not past, not modality, but it is like a noun or a name made out of the verb, but it is not a participle. And Rig Veda is full of these injunctives. They are, you can meet them more than any other tense or any other form. So it's like a statement beyond any time or any modality, yes? Which can be read into any time or any modality. So these are all Ardha Dhatukas. Sarva Dhatukas are more essential to see that present tense spread into the future and the past. Not present tense, some kind of other tense which has to be defined as it is not now, not today, then that which has to be, the imperative, and that which could be, should be, if you will, then it is. That's it. Beautiful. No, not beautiful. Do you have such clarity in any other language? Simplicity and clarity.
And
living, yes, we have, but...
No, I mean the language is in flow.
Yeah.
Not fixed.
But the German is also much stronger, I would say. And it comes also here to that. Not too short, I think.
It's systematized.
The German has a lot of grammar, too.
Must be. Actually, if I will drag you into Russian, I could show you.
Russia has more.
It has many exceptions, endless number of exceptions. There are also interesting forms in Tamil, or also ancient Sanskrit language, where you can have such forms like Bhagavan, for example. Bhagavan is a participle form of the name, is the one who possesses Bhaga, or the Lord, yes? But you can use this name also in the second person, Bhagavah, when you address the person. O Bhagavan, in the ancient language, will be O Bhagavah. That means that there can be other form, Bhagavan, I, the one who is the possessor of the Bhaga. It's very close to the Tamil, where in agglutinative type you have affixes which are showing the relation to the person and the gender. The same in Slavic languages. You can say she is going or he is going. There will be a flexema within the verb. Yes. Verb will have a gender. Verb with gender, the same with Polish language. So, in English we don't have even such idea that it can be there. But in other languages it can join them. So in Sanskrit there was those ancient forms in the Veda which had the same flexema as in... why I'm mentioning this now, that in other Slavic languages. Then later it dropped out. It became more analytic, and so on. Okay, so it's for today enough. These are fundamentals. If we look into them again and again and study them, then we will become familiar with Sanskrit language very easily. There's not much, you see. Only few things. You can count them on them. 1, 2, 3, 4, and finish. Yes, like that. It's not so difficult. It's not endless varieties of forms, endless varieties of... But from these you can create so many intermediary forms. You can create 124 participles from one root, and they will be all transparent in form. Okay, so shall we end today? We will have maybe tea if it comes. No, no tea today, sorry. I prepared for us later to go into these words of cognition and to see how cognition is expressed in Sanskrit. You will see all these words which define cognition, and we can dwell on them longer, why they are different and why there are so many. Yeah? And it would be interesting just psychologically to see what kind of things we have in Sanskrit and how they are used. This is the whole article. It's actually on the website. If you want, you can download it for yourself. All these definitions of consciousness and Sri Aurobindo's definitions, and how they can enlarge their scope and change their meanings through upasargas. So, okay, so let us end with a minute of silence. So you can see that in the verb, the actualization of the noun is taking through the present tense, actualization of the noun, and non-actualization through imperfect, action of the first person through the imperative, and also other action involving the decision of the second person through the optative. So this we don't have in the noun system. That's what distinguishes it from the verb.